All right, well, we're picking up tonight in Luke chapter 9 once again. Luke chapter 9, and we pick up our study this evening in verse 37. We left off in our previous study with the story of the Transfiguration, where Jesus, you remember, took Peter, James, and John and went up on that high mountain, probably Mount Hermon, and was there transfigured before their eyes. His appearance was altered, and he was there momentarily in a glorified state. So, verse 37, now it happened on the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great multitude met him. Suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, saying, "Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child, and behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out, it convulses him, so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." So they come down from this literal mountaintop experience where, I mean, it doesn't get any better than this. You remember Peter said, let's make three tabernacles, one for Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and let's just stay here permanently. It was a glorious experience, to say the least. But now immediately after that glorious mountaintop experience, they come down the mountain and they're met by the devil, literally. And, you know, it seems that that does so often happen. It seems that we have these times where we have these great experiences, these great blessings spiritually. And it just seems like, man, it couldn't get any better than this. And then sometimes immediately afterwards, we come under intense attack. I'll tell you, anybody who preaches on a regular basis on Sundays knows that, you know, Monday's usually a gloomy sort of a day, regardless of what the weather is like. And, you know, it's an attack. And I experience that so often myself. You know, you just sense that there's this great victory. You sense that God is really moving and he's touching people's lives and it's all exciting. And boy, sometimes, you know, you wake up the next day and you feel like, you know, I just want to quit. You know, I'm the worst preacher in the world. I should have just stayed in bed yesterday morning. And, you know, all of these things go through your head and it's warfare. We tend to think when we're on those mountaintops that it's just going to, you know, it's going to get better and better from here. But there's always that counter. The enemy comes with the counter attack. And here we see it happening. Now, notice this man says to Jesus, he says, "I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." So, of course, this must have happened while Jesus, Peter, James, and John were up on the top of the mountain. So the other disciples that would have remained behind, the other nine, they were the ones that he's referring to who were incapable of delivering this boy from this situation. Now, what a tragic situation it is, isn't it? You know, here's a father and his only son, and somehow, we don't have any idea how, a demonic spirit has got control of this young child's life. Well, at least he seems to be a young child. Maybe could have been maybe even a teenager. We don't know. But how many parents have found themselves in a similar kind of a situation where your child, the one that you love so much and the one that you invested so much in and you saw so much promise in their life and you remember them from their infancy and growing up and maybe, you know, those times even as a little one where they just had such a tender heart to the Lord. And then at some point in time, something happens and the devil gets a hold of their lives. It's one of the most heart-wrenching things that any parent can ever go through. And so here's this man, and that's where he's at. He's devastated over the situation. And he obviously hears that Jesus has power to deal with this sort of thing. So he evidently goes in search of Jesus. But he comes into contact with his disciples. And he finds that they are incapable of doing what needs to be done. I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Then Jesus answered and said, listen to this, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? O faithless and perverse generation. In some ways, doesn't this seem really out of character for Jesus? I mean, we, of course, find Jesus quite often giving rebuke to the hypocritical religious leaders of his day, but we rarely find the Lord strongly rebuking his own disciples. And the context, I think, lends itself mostly to the fact that it was the disciples that he was rebuking. It was that group of nine that stayed behind. It was the ones who were unable to deliver this child from this demonic control. And so Jesus is uncharacteristically upset with them. Why is he upset? I mean, does the Lord really get upset at us? Isn't he long-suffering and patient? And of course, he is. And we emphasize that. But we have to remember there are also times when we can sort of, I want to be careful here, but we can sort of exasperate the Lord. And that seems like what's happened here. He's exasperated. There's a sense of frustration in his words to these men. Why? Because they should have been able to do what needed to be done based on all of their previous experience with him. The problem that they had, the parallel accounts in Matthew and Mark tell us their problem was a lack of faith. They asked him the question, Lord, why couldn't we do it? He said, because of your unbelief. Now, unbelief is understandable if you're a new believer, if you haven't had a whole lot of experience with the Lord, you haven't really seen God do, anything extraordinary. And of course, for new believers, young believers, immature people in the faith, there will be sort of a natural element of unbelief just because of a lack of growth, development, and experience. But in every Christian's life, there comes a point where we ought to reach a level of maturity where we do have faith. And that's the frustration that Jesus has with these men. I mean, if you think of all of the things that they have seen up until this point, they have seen Jesus raise the dead. They've seen Jesus cast out demons. They've seen Jesus heal incurable diseases. They've seen Jesus feed multitudes of people with a few loaves of bread and a couple of fish. They've seen Jesus stand up in the midst of a storm and say to the wind, be still, and the waves, to be calm. They've seen all of this. But they still are filled with unbelief. I said this on Sunday night. I don't want to be repeating myself too much here. But it's the same sort of idea. God expects progress in our lives. He expects us to grow. He expects us to mature. He expects our faith to increase. He doesn't want us having baby faith when we should have adolescent faith. He doesn't want us having adolescent faith when we should have young adult faith. He doesn't want us having young adult faith when we should have senior citizen faith. He wants us growing in our faith. And these things that happen in our lives are meant to teach us that God is faithful. So when we encounter these things, our faith is supposed to have grown, and our ability to deal with these kinds of situations is intended by God to increase through a process of time. So it was because of their unbelief. And so Jesus says, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long? How long shall I be with you and bear with you?" In other words, how much is it going to take? How much is it going to take? I remember talking to a person quite a few years ago now, but I was talking to a friend who's a pastor, and we were having a conversation, and it was pretty clear to me, because I'd had numerous conversations with him about this, it was pretty clear to me that God was challenging him to take a step out of where he was and to take a step into something new. And it was, I could see so clearly that he just was not wanting to do that, that he really didn't have faith to do that. And so at one point I challenged him. I said, "You know, you need to take this step of faith. And until you do, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to improve. You're going to stay in the same frustration that you're in." And he said this. He said, "Well, you know, I have this past where, you know, God makes it all clear before me. And then when he makes it all clear what I'm supposed to do, then I step into it." And I said, "Listen, that's baby faith. When God has to spell it out all before you, there's just a little bit of faith that's necessary. But as you grow and as your faith increases, things aren't spelled out as clearly as they used to be. Things aren't necessarily laid out like that." In other words, I said to him, I said, "Look, you can't be expecting God to lead you now at this time in your life the same way he was leading you when you were a relatively young Christian. He's going to lead you in a different way." And our faith challenges will become just that, a little bit more challenging as the time goes on. We studied Genesis together, and of course you remember the situation with Abraham. God starts him out with some relatively simple things. He's to leave his family. He's to move out of his country. He's to go to a place that God is going to show him. And so he does that. And you know the story as you follow through the different things that God called Abraham to do by faith. But then what was the ultimate test? It was to take Isaac, the most difficult challenge of all time. But Abraham was up for it. He had grown to the point where he was up for that test of faith. So that's why Jesus is expressing frustration, because they are still in unbelief when they should have had their faith strengthened and increased. They should have been able to deal with it at this point. So Jesus says, "Bring your son here." And as he was still coming, the demon threw him down and convulsed him. Then Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the child, and gave him back to his father. Now, one other thing, just to connect with the parallel passages again. You remember when the disciples asked him, "Lord, why couldn't we do this?" He says it was because of your unbelief. And then he added something to it. He said, "But this kind only comes out through prayer and fasting." So Jesus did say that there was sort of an extraordinary demonic kind of a situation there that called for some intense spiritual battle. It called for prayer and it called for fasting. And you know, there are people that we know around us. There might even be people that are amongst us who the enemy has a stronghold in their lives. And we need to pray for them. We need to fast for them, that those strongholds would be broken. That's how strongholds are broken. The devil has a stronghold on our culture, doesn't he? It's a stronghold on our youth. And how is that stronghold going to be broken? Well, prayer and fasting. We need to pray. We need to fast as well. So, verse 43, "And they were all amazed at the majesty of God." They were just amazed at how Jesus, with just an authoritative word, delivered this boy. "But while everyone marveled at all the things which Jesus did, he said to his disciples, 'Let these words sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men.'" Jesus is wanting to remind them. Remember, he's already told them that the messianic program is going to be way different than they thought. It wasn't going to be an immediate restoration of the kingdom to Israel, but the Messiah, who Jesus was actually going to be rejected. He was going to be crucified. And so again, as they're all elated, it seems like what he had previously told them kind of went in one ear and out the other. So they're all excited, you know, oh, the majesty of God, the kingdom is here. Let these words sink down deep into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men. But they did not understand the saying, and it was hidden from them, so that they did not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about this saying. Now, then a dispute arose among them as to which of them would be the greatest. And Jesus, perceiving the thought of their heart, took a little child and set him by him. Now, anybody who's read the Bible realizes rather quickly that the disciples were just a bunch of ordinary guys. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, we had a big, giant Bible on the coffee table. And, you know, as you would open that Bible, there would be the Gospel of St. John and the Gospel of St. Luke, and then the Epistles of St. Paul, and then the Revelation of St. John the Divine. And, you know, oftentimes they would have pictures of what the apostles might have looked like. And quite often they, you know, sort of had a halo or some sort of a glow about them. All of that is dispelled when you read the pages of the New Testament. They were just a bunch of ordinary people like we are. And they had the same weaknesses and struggles and stupid ideas that we have. And here they are. Jesus is talking about the fact that he's about to be betrayed. And what are they doing? They're in an argument over who's going to be the greatest. Who's going to be the greatest? These guys are thoroughly human. And we can identify with this, can't we? It's so easy for us to get swept up in pride and not even realize it. I'm sure they're not thinking of it in those terms, but they're just typical. They're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. So Jesus takes this young child and he says, whoever receives this little child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives him who sent me. For he who is least among you will be great. So Jesus is teaching them these lessons that they would have to learn if they were going to be able to accomplish the ultimate task that he would give them of taking the gospel out into the world. They couldn't be disputing over who was going to be the greatest. They'd never get anything done. So he had to teach them that they needed to humble themselves, is basically what he's telling them. They need to become like this child. They need to be without guile. They need to be freed up from this pride. They needed to be delivered from this competitiveness. Now, again, these things are so ingrained into our human nature, aren't they? And these are the kinds of things that sometimes are the hardest things to see rooted out of our lives. They're the things that take the longest for us to overcome. Pride is one of those things. It's so insidious to our nature. And, you know, it's just about the time that you think you're pride-free and you've reached that state of total humility where some occasion comes along and your pride flares up again. And you think, how did that happen? And it's crazy the way we can be like this, and we can be competing and doing these kinds of things. But again, it's perfectly human. That's exactly what these guys were doing. But the lesson is you need to humble yourself. A child, of course, is humble. A child, up until a certain point, you know, children really don't have pride. They're happy to be dependent on somebody else. They're content to just, you know, trust everything into somebody else's hands. They don't have to control everything. You know, it seems that we reach a certain point in life where we all become control freaks, where we just got to control the situation. That's a form of pride. So they needed to receive little children and learn lessons from them, become more like them. Now, John answered and said, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we forbade him because he does not follow with us." So John is the first sectarian in the church. He's got his own denomination already developing. And he sees somebody from a different denomination. And they're not doing it exactly the way we would do it within our denomination or movement. So what does John do? He says, "We forbade him. He's not part of us. What is he doing? He can't be doing that." But what does Jesus say? Jesus says, "Do not forbid him. For he who is not against us is on our side." Again, we're dealing with very typical human kinds of weaknesses and faults. We tend to think that our group is the best. We tend to think that sometimes we're the only, you know, real Christians. Everybody else has just somehow missed it to some degree. You know, somebody once said that ideas are like children. You like your own the best. And, you know, I found that to be really true. I like my own ideas better than anybody else's. And I like my own way of doing things better than I like the way other people do things. And it's easy for us to get into this mindset that if people don't do it exactly the way we do it, then they're somehow doing it wrong and they should be forbidden from doing it. We can't think that way. Jesus said, "Do not forbid them." We have to realize the body of Christ is much bigger than we think. It extends beyond the borders of Fairview and Sunflower. It extends beyond the borders of the Calvary movement. It extends far and wide, all around the world. God is working through all different kinds of groups of people. And we don't always agree in the, you know, the particular philosophy. And a lot of times what happens in with the church today, especially, I think what happens a lot of times is we're all in disagreement with people that we should be in fellowship with, but we're in disagreement not over any serious doctrinal issue. We're in disagreement over more philosophy type of things, ways of doing ministry. There are a ton of different ways that people do ministry. And some people prefer to do it one way. Some people prefer to do it another way. But, you know, to some extent, you have to realize that philosophy of ministry, the variations are allowed by God to reach all different kinds of people. And just because somebody doesn't do it exactly the way we do it, doesn't mean that they're doing it wrong. They're just doing it differently. But we tend to think that if they're not doing it the way we're doing it, then they're somehow doing it wrong. And in some cases, we'd like to forbid them. We'd like to prevent them. No, you can't do that. You know, I've often wondered and had to search my own heart. You know, as I've prayed for God to do a great work and to pour out his Spirit, and I think particularly in the context of the UK, as we've been involved in ministry over there for so many years, and, you know, praying and hoping and believing that God would do a great work and pour out his Spirit. And I've often had to sort of check myself, you know, would I be as happy about God pouring out his Spirit there if he did it through somebody other than me? And I had to really search my heart and say, well, Lord, I'd like to be involved, but, you know, if you want to use somebody else, it's the main point is, of course, that God would just get his work done. So these are things that we have to be careful about. We have to be on our guard. And this is why Paul says in writing to the Ephesians, this is why he says we must endeavor to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. We have to put forth an effort because our tendency is going to be to divide. Our tendency is going to be to fractionalize because that's just the way we are naturally. And we have to realize that God is working through all different kinds of people. And he's using different ministries. And he's working with people that hold to different philosophies than we do. He's working with people that hold different doctrinal positions than we hold. I have a good friend who we met when we were pastoring in London. He and his wife were Americans who lived in England as well. And he became part of the church. And we got really, really close. We used to have a home Bible study at his house. And we've talked for many years about the possibility of them eventually coming here someday and all of this. But they've ended up for many years now in back in Chicago. And they've tried some different churches. But, you know, they've ended up at this one fellowship there in the Chicago area. And it's a great church. It's a great ministry. And the pastor's a, you know, fantastic guy. He's a great preacher of the word. But he definitely holds some different views than we do as Calvary Chapel. And this friend of mine, he's just sort of got the Calvary gene. You know, he really caught it. And so he's, you know, he's a gung-ho Calvary person. So what he will do quite often is he will send me messages from his pastor and he'll say, okay, Brian, check this out. Now tell me, what do you think? Because I'm not sure about what he said here, you know, so I'll listen through it and I'll get back and I'll say, well, you know, I think he kind of went out on a limb there and I don't necessarily agree with that, but it's okay. It's nothing heretical. It's nothing to say, I can't go to this guy's church because of that. And so, you know, last week he called me with another thing. He said, he said this, and I can't believe that he thinks that. And I said, yeah, that's stupid. I can't believe that he came to that conclusion either, but he's still a good man, and he's still being used by God. And that's a peripheral thing. It's a side issue. It's not anything to get worked up and especially to be divided over. So Jesus said it. Don't forbid him. He who is not against us is on our side. Now it came to pass when the time had come for him to be received up, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. So there comes this point where Jesus now has got one thing on his mind, and that is going to Jerusalem and accomplishing God's purpose in him laying down his life. So this is the thing now, at this moment, this is the thing that is now taking control of Jesus. And everything else is becoming secondary. So he goes with this focus, and he sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. So it's interesting just exactly how they understood that his focus was Jerusalem. We don't know, but somehow they sensed that, and there was a coldness. Now remember, from John's gospel, we learn that there was a great division between the Jews and the Samaritans. They were people that were at enmity toward one another. There was a racial and a religious prejudice coming from both directions. So Jesus looks like he's set for Jerusalem. The Samaritans have no love for Jerusalem or the Jews. They believe that the place to worship God was Mount Gerizim. And so, because of this, they did not receive him. Now, when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, Listen to this. Do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them just as Elijah did? So Peter and John, or James and John, these guys, you know, Lord, they're not receiving you. How about if we just nuke the whole village? It doesn't matter. You know, we'll just nuke them all. And, you know, isn't it true that we get like that sometimes? Isn't it true that sometimes we have more of a sense of a message of the day of the vengeance of our God rather than the message of the acceptable year of the Lord? Remember when Jesus was in the synagogue back in Luke chapter 4? And he stands up and he reads through the prophecy of Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, to give sight to the blind," and all the way down. And then it goes, the last thing he says, "and to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And he stops right there. If you go back to the prophecy in Isaiah, immediately after preaching the acceptable year of the Lord, it says, "and the day of the vengeance of our God." But Jesus cut it short there. He didn't say the day of the vengeance of our God. He said he came to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. But these guys had the mentality of the day of the vengeance of our God. They wanted to bring down fire. Now, they had a precedent for it biblically. They said, like Elijah did. But if you go back in the story, it was a bit of a different situation back in Elijah's day. But nevertheless, this is their attitude. "But he turned and rebuked them and said, 'You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them.' And they went to another village." Jesus said, "Are you guys nuts? No. I don't want you to nuke the village. That's not what I've come to do. I've come not to destroy, but to save." And we have to be careful, as the disciples of Jesus in our generation, not to adopt the wrong spirit. Because think about this. Think about the great harvest that took place in Samaria after the day of Pentecost. And you never know but what many of those in that Samaritan village might have come to Christ later. You see, we don't know where people are really at. And somebody might, at a given moment, give the impression that they are rejecting Christ. And we might be tempted to say, "Lord, call down fire from heaven and destroy them." But you know, we don't know that in a year from now, circumstances might change and their heart might change and they might be open to the Lord. I'm going to ask this question. How many of you in this room tonight would say that there was a time in your life when you actually rejected Christ, but now you're a Christian today? Anybody in here like that? Well, hallelujah. Isn't that great that nobody called down fire from heaven on you when you were in that place you were in? I was in that place at one time too. But let's remember that, because the problem is we forget that and we want to call down fire and we want to see God judge. And this is not the time of the day of the vengeance of our God. It is still the acceptable year of the Lord. This is the time when God is saving people. And we have to leave the judgment thing in God's hands. I love what he says. "You don't know what spirit you are of. This is not why I've come. I've not come to destroy, but I've come to save." Now, real quickly, the last few verses here. "Now it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, 'Lord, I will follow you wherever you go.' And Jesus said to him, 'Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.'" Now, Jesus is wanting this man to really consider what he's saying. He's wanting this man to know that following him might mean that he would end up not having a place to lay his head. Jesus would ask the man, are you ready for that? That's really what he's doing. Foxes have holes, birds have nests. I don't have anywhere to lay my head. You say that you want to follow me? Are you sure? Because it might involve this. It might entail this. A lot of times we can be very zealous. Oh, Lord, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do that for you. And we haven't weighed out the cost that it might include things that we haven't really thought about. Jesus always wanted people to weigh it out. He wanted them to know what they were getting into. Jesus wasn't into, you know, tricking anybody into the kingdom or bringing them in under false pretenses, promising them something and then ultimately giving them something else. He wanted them to know up front. And so another said to him, or he said to another, follow me. But he said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Jesus said to him, let the dead bury their own dead, but you go and preach the kingdom of God. Now, it seems rather cruel, doesn't it? Here's a man who's saying, Lord, I really want to follow you, but I've got to attend my father's funeral. Jesus says, no, you don't need to. Let the dead bury their dead. I don't think Jesus was heartless in any way, shape, or form. I think from his response, what you can learn is this, that man was using that as an excuse. He was using it as an excuse. It was a means of procrastination. Lord, I want to follow you, but first, I've got to do something else. And that's what Jesus is not allowing for. He's not allowing for procrastination. In other words, if you're going to follow me, then follow me. All of those other things, you can; those will get sorted out. They'll get taken care of. Jesus wasn't being cruel or heartless to the man. He was pinpointing the procrastination in his own heart. And another also said, Lord, I will follow you, but first let me go and bid them farewell who are at my house. But Jesus said to him, no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. Well, these are heavy things that Jesus is saying, aren't they? Now, I want you to notice the context of all of these exchanges is the context of discipleship. It's the context of service. It's the context of following the Lord. It's not, in other words, it's not the context of salvation. And it's important to make that distinction. Jesus is not talking about salvation here, the free gift of God. He's talking about discipleship. He's talking about service. And when he calls us into service, he's saying that we need to realize that serving him might involve some discomfort. It might take us completely out of our comfort zone. And if we're used to living a comfortable life, we're not going to really be able to be his disciple. We've got to weigh those things out. Now, of course, if Jesus calls you to be a disciple and you decide, no, I don't want to be, that creates a whole new series of problems. But I think it's important to see that it is discipleship. So when he says no one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God, he's not saying that if you ever started out with the Lord and then looked back, you can't go to heaven. He's simply making a point that you can never advance forward while you're looking backward. And a disciple is somebody who needs to keep moving forward. So if I'm going to spend my life looking back, I'm not fit for the kingdom. I'm not going to be able to do the kingdom any real service because I'm distracted. I've got my eye on something else. And so when we come to the Lord, when he calls us into service, he wants us not looking back, but he wants us looking straight ahead. And when a person looks back, they can't move forward. You know, when I was a kid, I used to be involved in track and field and all of that sort of stuff. And I would run in relay races and things. And, you know, in a race, whatever type of a race it might be, there's one thing you can never do. And you know what it is? You can never look back. You look back and you're guaranteed to lose the race. And it's happened over and over and over again that people just ahead and they're, you know, they've got it made. They're going to win, but they're just curious, where's that other person at? And I'll just take a look back. And as soon as they look back, the person passes them up. It's happened over and over again. And so Jesus says, you can't look back. When you put your hand to the plow, keep moving forward. Remember the children of Israel as we're studying with the whole situation there. What did they keep doing? They kept looking back to Egypt. Oh, Egypt was so nice. All the meat and the garlic and all of those great things we had. They were looking back. They could never move forward. And so God is calling us to move forward, and we can't do that by looking back. So rather than spending time, and you know, even I would say in closing, even looking back sometimes at good things, you know, even looking back at good things, we can sort of hinder ourselves to some degree from looking forward. And even as we look back at what God's done in our lives and many good things, and those are all good, but of course, if we spend all of our time thinking about what God has done in the past, we might miss out on what he wants to do in the present and the future. So, having put our hands to the plow, let's keep moving forward.